Thanks, Bob. So a lot of this, I think if you guys have been watching already in the session so far, we've talked about this being one of the hidden places that we're probably not. We've been talking about addressing for a long time and having a difficult time addressing really well in BIF and other organization. And it's not necessarily for lack of research. It's not for or lack of trying. But this is a tricky beast to try to tackle because of the multifaceted nature of respiratory disease, for instance. And really, this can some of the problems here can go toward just about any disease complex in trying to tackle. The hopeful thing is that if you try to do this, it's not going to be something that's solved just by genetics. It probably takes a combination of immunologists, vaccinologists, DVMs, epidemiologists. I could go on and on here, and trying to figure out ways that you can make incremental changes and actually do something about that. So the important thing is to keep your eyes open and realizing that there might be measures that you're taking phenotypically that do a good job with this in a year, with the disease you happen to have that year, the pathogen you happen to have that year, trying to keep a way open to see what you can do that is going to keep applying in years to come. And that's really the challenge of this, but it's also the opportunity if we can get all these things to work together. And that's kind of what we want to spread around and what we hope to do with some of our program at the Mean Animal Research Center. So I'm going to just kind of cover where we've been and where we've been going. Most of this you guys are pretty aware of in terms of costs of respiratory disease to the industry right now. These are actually pretty old numbers now, but they get quoted all the time, so I'm kind of obligated to use the same quotations everybody else does. It costs a lot of money. It costs $40 a head less return on every calf that gets treated for respiratory disease. You see numbers that were back in the early 2000s of $1 billion to the industry per year. Who thinks money's the same as it was in the early 2000s, right? We're definitely probably spending more on that, and it's costing the industry more today. And Allison and Mike worked on a project a number of years ago saying that the value was 40 times that of yearling weight in an economic index, I think. That was part of an early stage of the CAP grant, I believe. So all of these things, antibiotics, vaccination, and management all can effectively decrease the incidence of respiratory disease, but there's a lot of concern over antibiotic resistance, and it's hard to control across all sectors. And just when you think you have this tackled, you end up with a train wreck, and all those happen. One of the most difficult things about this as a disease is that it's hard to diagnose. And if I were looking at this and I'm a cowboy, I might say that animal on the left might just have a little bit of snot on his nose. And if I were looking at it and I had time to spend 2 minutes on each animal per day in the feedlot to try to do it, I might end up pulling that animal in. But if I'm spending 3 seconds on a drive-by with trying to see who we want to send pen riders out to pull, I probably miss it. And that's a lot of what goes on with this disease right now. There's tools going on with this where the main problem, and animals are evolved to do this, especially grass-eating animals, they hide the symptoms, right? You just don't see it. And there's tools going on with temperature monitoring. We've got some producers that are really trying to do that right now. Progressively trying to tackle this, but it's difficult because of that subclinical nature of the disease, and animals don't show sick until they need to, because that's when they get killed. This is a laundry list that's not complete at all, but it's one that has some of the primary players in bacterial organisms that contribute to bacterial infections. My colleague Tara McDaniel will be talking more about this a little bit later in her talk, especially with relative to bacteria. But the culprit that most often gets implicated in shipping fever is Mannheimia hemolytica. It releases a leukotoxin that basically just goes after and destroys white blood cells that are coming to get it in the lungs. And probably the most defined and study of all of these, there are vaccines for this, but effectiveness is certainly not 100%. different types of pastorellas. Multocid is not the only one. Mycoplasma bovis. Tara, I'll talk a little bit in some of her slides too. Histophilus, somni, several bacterial. And I know I don't have a complete list here. There's Bibriostina. I mean, there's several other bacteria besides this. Those are just some of the major players. We usually treat, there's five primary viral agents we talk about, and four of these with two strains of BVDV are in the standard five-way vaccines that most of you probably give every year to your calves. These aren't, again, not conclusive. There are a lot of MLV, modified live vaccines for these. More recently, there's been a lot of implications toward bovine coronavirus, which is typically thought of as an enteric, a scours type of virus, but actually seems to be contributing a lot to summer pneumonia, wearing off with cows that after cows have given colostrum, and where that antibiotic in the colostrum seems to wear off after about 50 to 60 days, calves start to break, and that seems to be where this BCV might be coming in. We've got a virologist that's working in this area as well. And the big thing about most of these viruses is they don't seem that severe on their own. They can be, of course, but they're usually the gateway to something that's much more significant. In addition to these pathogens, there's a lot of environmental factors. The feedlot would just the fact that they're in the feedlot right now, the weight the animals come in at, the gender, the transport, the commingling, receiving ration, how far they've traveled, social dominance, on and on and on here, would all be stressors that could be causing increased or decreased incidence of respiratory disease in the feedlot. Prior treatment, obviously, we all know the value of sourced cattle and what's going on and what vaccine records they have going into this. Not having that can certainly be a problem. And then stress is just a huge factor, which crosses over all the things I mentioned here before and affects immune system dynamics. So there's a lot of models, if you pardon my oversimplification of the epidemiology here, towards BRDC overall. You may have a case where you see an animal break in the feedlot and he had something where he may have had been carrying bovine herpes virus or IBR coming into the feedlot and then got sick as a secondary infection with amheme. You may have an animal that had a lot of transport stress, came from Florida up to a feedlot in central Texas or something to that effect, went a long way, came through a sale barn, weaned into that sale barn, just went on a truck and then just couldn't fight it anymore and had amheme already in his system. It's a commensal bacteria. I failed to mention that earlier, and suddenly it starts to spike and turn against the animal because the animal has inflammation coming from the stress. BRSV, Pastorella multocida, are known to play together the same way, and they could have a little bit of everything, where you'd have a virus and then two different bacteria that kind of fight each other to try to take over. So this is a multifaceted, it really is a complex, and that's part of what makes this difficult is, as a geneticist, if I do something that's going to maybe control the entry of a virus into the cells or something to that effect through a transmembrane protein or something like that the virus is attaching to, that's going to fight one pathogen and probably not solve most of the rest of the problem here. And if you start taking away those gateways into cells, who knows what else you're doing in terms of receptors that may be allowing other things the body needs to actually function. Difficulties of treatment records, I think I've hinted at this already. Diseases measured as a 0-1. Subclinicals and shedders are analyzed as healthy. Symptoms are not precise indicators. That case where subclinicals are analyzed as healthy, there's a real problem with what's called specificity and sensitivity in these disease cases, where either you have animals that are being called healthy that are actually sick, or you have animals that end up spiking a fever sometimes that may be acidotic newly into a feedlot or something like that, and they're being called sick when they really don't have respiratory disease. And both of those are part of the reason why the heritability is so bad typically for studies on this. Prior exposure is often unknown, and you can't guarantee the level of exposure of all these pathogens, and it could be any set of pathogens that's causing the disease within any other given year. Could be multiple ones within a different year, within a year. So in order to overcome these difficulties, what we really think we need, one, is large population size. We've dedicated for the past 10 years a subset of the germplasm evaluation program to this, with around 800 head a year. And for the first 5 or so years of that, we had animals getting really sick, and we've had an epidemic where nothing's gotten sick here for the next 4 years or so. And so that can be difficult to follow when you're using disease as one of your major indicators of whether there's something we follow, and we're just not getting animals that get sick. But the way that we can try to overcome that a little bit is with other types of data collection. One, improving the diagnosis so we get those subclinicals, but another way is to identify measures that are correlated to resistance to these diseases, such as vaccine response, maybe inflammatory responses. Is the animal overactive with inflammation? Do we see a high, what's called with antibodies, a humoral response to the vaccines? Do we see the white blood cells go crazy when the animals get their booster vaccine, and can we do something off those white blood cell counts? There's measures that have been developed in Guelph that we're not necessarily doing, but that might indicate the overall immune status of the animal that I know there's people interested in looking at around the world as well. Those types of things are what we really need to do a good job of when we've got this disease complex that we don't know necessarily what the major factors are going to be in a given year in terms of pathogens. So what we've been doing overall then is we follow a standard vaccination protocol with a vaccine given at breeding. You'll see on that bottom line, somewhere around 70 days, although we have animals as young as, that line's probably not quite far enough, so probably as young as 30 days or so in that. But we'll give a vaccine at breeding. We'll do a sample collection at that time, which will be a nasal sample Tara will talk about in her talk here on the second half, or we'll take a blood sample to look at serology antibodies and current levels of circulating antibodies with from primarily that would be from passive transfer from the colostrum. We do it again at preconditioning, which we give a booster shot for the five-way viral vaccine and measure the antibodies off that booster, which is really the antibody response we expect to be all due to the animal and not due to the maternal antibody or the maternal antibody interference. And then do a blood sample again at weaning to look at how animals change over that time. And we intentionally put exactly 21 days between our preconditioning and weaning to have kind of a response curve to those antibodies being able to come up, or to those white blood cells that may be responding as a result, and kept that the same. Just an example of a project that came off this population. This was population was set up for genetics, but we've had a lot of byproducts. But this is one of the genetic results that have come from this in a paper published a little while ago, where we saw a strong genetic correlation to disease incidence, animals being polled with lymphocytes, that if lymphocytes basically increased over the due to the vaccine, we saw a decrease in disease resistance. So animals with a high propensity to have to respond to a stimulus with lymphocytes in part of a complete blood cell count would have lower incidence of respiratory disease. Okay, that's just an example, and I'm not making this result heavy, but what you can get out of a resource population like this, and what we think we can continue to do over time as we develop new measures in these populations to try to get at respiratory disease. And if we get at what I'd really like as a geneticist, but I can't ever really get because people say it costs too much money, I'd like to see things that measure the whole immune response overall when you have some sort of stimulus like a vaccine or an adjuvant or whatever the case might be, where we would be trying to measure maybe the cytokines, which are all these arrows with the little letters beside it. I won't get into what all these are, but these are interleukins, interferon gammas, whatever the case might be. that might trigger animals from one type of cellular response in term to pathogens to another type of cellular response, where the adaptive immune system may produce antibodies during one pathway, that'd be this humoral bottom portion, or the immune system may attack with a cell-mediated response, which would be this top portion. And maybe there's advantages and disadvantages to animals that seem to have one or more, one direction on this pathway or another. And that's the type of thing I think we need to get a better job and a better handle on measuring if we're going to do this well. I don't think I can do it for $5 an animal right now. So, and that can get expensive alone. But I think this is where we need to start going and being in a high multivariate situation to actually do this well. There's some of these measures I hinted at I think are a step toward it, like this Guelph measure that I talked about with high immune response, that sort of thing. I'd like to get more information even than that, especially in terms of specificity to the type of pathogens that we're talking about here. I want to be careful I don't take too much of Tara's time here, but the other thing that we need to do in addition to that, I think I kind of covered this, we need to make sure we're identifying the subclinicals as well as we can. And one thing we do to get at subclinicals that we don't catch in treatment records is actually score lungs at slaughter, which has some things where other things can cause lung lesion sometime, but the combination of the two lets us look at a basically overall a diagnostic picture that of animals that we probably missed during treatment. In addition to that, we can assess BRD risk when the animals don't get sick with things I've been talking about, cell counts, which I already talked about, publishing, vaccine response, acute response proteins, which are early inflammatory signals, basically, cytokine pathways, again, how the inflammatory system might be responding relative to what the immune system's doing, and the cytokines might tell us that. If we could get an idea of stress of the animals and something in behavior that I think could be pretty helpful would be social dominance interactions, where animals that tend to be low on the social dominance scale are the ones that tend to get sick more often. And if we could get an idea of that in our feedlot pens, I think we could probably have things that would tackle this a little bit better. Some of these we've implemented. Some of these are just still ideas at this point. In addition, I mentioned this is a multi-pronged approach. We're also trying to work with other institutions outside of the Meat Animal Research Center to get broad categories of large numbers of phenotypes at the same time from the industry. And one of those that I'll talk about here was trying to use commercial partners in order to get records that we may not get as fast with just the Meat Animal Research Center alone. So one of those is a grant we work on with Colorado State on cooperating feedlots to get treatment records from several cooperating feedlots to try to target somewhere around 5,000 cases and contemporary controls on those animals for the grant. We've done that already and are analyzing it right now. Ryan Bolt back here is responsible for some of that analysis and shaking his head at me right now. There's also we've worked with abattoirs directly. I'll go into that just a little bit, where we sampled around 12,000 animals that from processing plant with a throughput of about 2,500 cattle per 8 shifts. So we went through several shifts in the feedlot and looked at lung lesions. On average, to get to that 11,000, we sampled 900 lungs per day, where about half of them were cases where they were very severe lung scores, and half of them were controls where we saw no evidence of lung problems, lung lesions. Majority of these were, in this case, we targeted the natural kills that this plant had, so we had no antibiotics in these, and that just helped the incidence rate go up, and ended up with about little over 5,500 of each as a result. We scored them as severe if greater than 50% of the lung was showing lung lesions, and we used a sampling message where we tried to basically use proximity on the chain to get a contemporary group type of effect on there, assuming that animals that were close together on the chain probably came from the same feedlot, which is generally going to be true. And so basically we avoided long runs of sick or healthy animals, like that first example, and tried to pick cases where we could see a normal animal close to a lung lesion animal instead. Okay, I thought that was a pretty good idea, and it's worked out pretty well for us. And ended up with an association analysis of some markers that seemed to both be indicative of some immune function and also of tissue repair mechanisms that might be cases where animals get sick with BRD, but their lungs are repairing after treatment. And so that might be a case where lung lesions are actually a little bit different than treatment records. With that, I just want to highlight a little bit more where we're trying to go with gene expression and things like that, and how this disease measurement could kind of spill over into feed efficiency, in that feed efficiency and disease both are highly dependent on inflammatory response. There's some evidence out there from one of our research scientists, Amanda Lindholm-Perry, at the Meat Animal Research Center, where inflammatory response seems to be, over-inflammation seems to be contributing to loss of feed efficiency in the cattle on some of the studies she's been looking at. So she had an interest in this when we were measuring these animals anyway for disease resistance, and has been running cytokine RNA panels on all of this to make sure to see if she could detect possible inflammatory pathways on animals in that. She's been taking RNA tubes then at the same time we had that earlier schedule, and looking at animals that got sick and see if the inflammatory responses that she's seen when the animals are going through preconditioning and weaning are indicative of animals that are getting sick later. And we've got a small pilot that we published on this. She's going to continue that on all of our 800 or so head here in the future. So I won't go too much deeper into that in the interest of time and letting Tara kind of go forward here a little bit. But all of that data gathered does a good job of trying to make sure we have that big multivariate picture as much as we possibly can to get an idea of indicator measurements that do better than just disease treatment records for respiratory disease overall. So we need this multi-pronged approach. We need cases with industry partners. We need to be working with a whole lot of disciplines if we're going to tackle this. And the studies I've shown here and other ones I didn't show, we can keep using resource populations like this to chip away at it over time. So with that, Tara's going to talk about one of our big chips that we're trying to go through over time with metagenomics and the nasal sample of these animals. So.
All right, so I'm going to talk about bacteria that we've been looking at when looking at respiratory disease, and I'll be talking a little bit about metagenomics. So what metagenomics is basically is you're just looking at the genetics of the bacteria. So you're identifying the bacteria that are present. In this case, we're looking at respiratory disease, so we're looking at the bacteria that are present in the upper nasal cavity. So like Larry alluded to earlier, we've been studying BRD for a number of years. Okay. Is it working now? Can you hear me? Awesome. All right, so like Larry said, you know, we've been looking at respiratory disease for a number of years, and unfortunately, when it comes down to it, we really haven't gotten that far, and which is a little disappointing, but I'm going to give you some ideas of how we at the Meat Animal Research Center are tackling respiratory disease to hopefully move it along. So with talking about metagenomics, the bacteria that are present, this really all started with the Human Microbiome Project, and where they were able to, what they did was they took samples all across the body, whether it be on the surface or whether it be inside the body, and what they found that the bacterial populations were different across these different regions. And not only are the bacterial populations different, but they also have an influence on phenotypes. You know, a lot of times when we talk about bacteria, everybody thinks, well, the bacteria are bad, we need to get rid of them. Well, that's not the case. Most of the bacteria in our body are actually, they're supposed to be there, and they're helping us out. probably one of the best examples about how bacteria affects a phenotype is when they looked at lean and obese people. When they looked at the gut population, the bacteria, they saw that the populations were different between lean and obese individuals. And they've actually swapped gut contents, specifically in mice, and what they found was when they swapped the gut contents, those obese individuals actually lost weight to become more lean. So it gave a good example of how the bacterial populations influence a phenotype. So just to talk a little bit about Game of Thrones here, I like to talk about compare the bacterial populations to Game of Thrones. I don't know how many of you got involved with Game of Thrones. I got sucked in very early. But similar to bacterial populations, we have a population of characters in this show. Some are good, some are bad. Sometimes something comes in, disrupts the population, and all hell breaks loose. And if you know anything about Game of Thrones, there's dragons, and you don't want to get attached to anybody because they're probably going to die. And so when we talk about bacteria, you know, a lot of people think that, you know, you just need to obliterate everything and start new. And that's really not the case what we want to do. I really want to stress the importance of looking at the bacterial population and the impact that it does have. So when we talk about metagenomics, we're not looking at a single isolate. You know, Larry was talking about the different bacteria that influence respiratory disease. And so we don't just want to talk about mycoplasma. We don't want to talk about Manhamia hemolytica. We want to look at the entire population that's present and how they interact and how they change across time. So with the population that Larry was talking about, we want to see how the bacteria changes in sick and control animals. You know, is there something early on in these animals that get sick in the feedlot that predisposes them to getting sick? So just talk about some of the stuff we have at the Research Center in order to tackle this. Is the first thing, if you know anything about the Meal Research Center, we have a lot of cattle populations. We have over 30,000 acres of land and a lot of cattle. We don't just focus on a single breed. We focus on multiple breeds. So we have a lot of variation that we can look at and incorporate into the animals we look at. We also have the technology. On center, we have the ability to genotype animals, sequence animals, and we incorporate that into this project. And then, of course, when talking about data analysis, I'm talking about the people. Many times people talk about the research center and say you can't swing a cat without hitting a quantitative geneticist, and that's very true. And all those people are working together for this project, which you'll see at the very end, for just the number of people that have worked on this project. And by bringing all these entities together, we think we really have a good handle on being able to look at respiratory disease and hopefully move forward as to how we can hopefully eradicate respiratory disease at some point. So Larry has already shown this slide, but just want to give you an idea again of our sample collection for this population that I'm going to show results from. Prior to weaning, we take two additional samples. A lot of times when people look at respiratory disease, they only look at those animals in the feedlot when they get sick. They have no idea what's going on prior to that. And so we actually want to look at our population of animals prior to weaning. And so we take a sample at pre-breeding and at preconditioning, and then, of course, when the animal enters the feedlot. As far as samples that are collected, we take nasal swabs. We do this to look at the bacterial side of things, and also we have a virologist who's looking at the viral side. I'll just be presenting the bacterial side of things. We also take a blood sample, which Larry's already talked about what we do with that. Our virologist at one point was also taking fecal swabs to not only see what's in the nasal tract, but also seeing what the animal is shedding. And then at some point, we hope to also be able to take tissues from chronic animals. You know, when the animal's alive, there's only so many samples you can take. Usually you're pretty limited to nasal swabs and blood samples in this case. But we'd also like to look at the rest of the respiratory tract, you know, not just upper nasal cavity, but what's going on in the lungs of those animals also. So to get started with one of the projects we've done, like I said, there's 700 to 800 animals in this project, and they're located at different sections across the center. So this is an aerial view of the center, and we're looking at, there's a pointer. So we're looking at three different locations for these cattle, and this is basically where the cattle are born and where they are raised until weaning. And we wanted to see if the bacterial populations in these animals was different between the locations. So we have three different locations, one up in the northern part, then we have 46, which is located here, and then 18 or 29, which is located in the southern part of the center. So none of these locations share fence lines, so they're all separate until they're weaned. So this is some data from 2015 from these animals, and just to set this up for you real quick, we have the three time points we're looking at. We're looking at pre-breeding, preconditioning, and weaning. And then across the bottom, we have our three pole shed locations, where the first two bars for each graph is the first pole shed, then we have the second pole shed, and the third pole shed. Now, each of these bars represents the bacteria that are present in the upper nasal cavity of those animals. So basically, each color represents a different bacteria. So first, looking at the different time points, we can see that the profiles of the bacteria change as we go from pre-breeding. We have a pretty diverse set of bacteria present. We move on to preconditioning, and the bacteria that really takes over at preconditioning is Mycoplasma. And as Laurie pointed out in her previous slide, Mycoplasma has been associated with respiratory disease. And then we move into weaning. Again, we have some Mycoplasma, but we also have some other bacteria present that are associated with respiratory disease, Moraxella, and Cyclobacter. So we do see changes in the bacterial profiles as the animal moves from pre-breeding to weaning. So then when we look at location, again, we see differences. Specifically looking at preconditioning between the three different pole sheds, the third pole shed definitely has calves with a lot more Mycoplasma. And then when we move to weaning, this kind of switches, where the first pole shed has a lot more Mycoplasma compared to the other three locations. So this just gives you an idea that not only do the populations change between time points as the animal matures, but it also differs between locations where the animals are at before they go into weaning at the feedlot. So the next thing we wanted to do was actually look at sick calves in the feedlot, those that are diagnosed with respiratory disease and get diagnosed. So we want to look at, I have 3 weeks represented here of animals in the feedlot, the first week with the first two bars, then the second week, and the third week. The first bar will be the controls, and then the second bar will be the case animals, or those that are diagnosed with respiratory disease. So specifically when we move into week two and week three, we see differences between those control animals and the case animals. Where in the case animals, you know, Mycoplasma is present in both the case and control animals. But when we look at the case animals, we also see a lot of Cyclobacter and Moraxella present, indicating that possibly in 2015, these might have been the bacteria associated with respiratory disease. Now, we've been doing this for a number of years, and it seems like every year it's a different bacteria that's present. Early on in 2012, it was Mannheimia hemolytica. And then in some of the most recent years, it's been Mycoplasma. And so that's what Larry was alluding to earlier, is it's a complex disease. It's not always the same bacteria. It's not always the same viral agent. And so this just goes, again, to show that we are seeing differences in the bacteria that are present. So the last thing I'm going to talk about is a mass treatment that we had at one of our pole shed locations. And this occurred prior to weaning. So it's actually between the right before preconditioning in these animals, where there's three groups of cattle at pole shed 18. Two of them were mass treated for respiratory disease and the other was not. So we started with the first group of calves that came in and they weren't looking good. They were lethargic, they had nasal discharge, they had respiratory issues, high temperatures, and so they decided to mass treat the entire first group. Then the next week, you know, 7 days later, we had the second group that came in, and they looked worse than the first group, where they, you know, had even higher temps, a higher percentage of those that were having respiratory issues and, you know, discharge from the nose and from the eyes, droopy ears, all the classical symptoms. And so we sampled these calves and were able to identify some bacteria that were present. So for the mass treatment, we have samples from the first mass treated group, the second mass treated group, and then this was from the animals that were not treated. So it's pretty easy to see when comparing to those animals that weren't treated, that didn't show signs of respiratory disease, that there's definitely a difference in the bacterial populations that are present. Again, we see a lot of Mycoplasma in those animals that were diagnosed with respiratory disease and treated. And then we also have this guy showing up, Haemophilus, which has been associated with respiratory disease. And this was the first time we really saw Haemophilus. You know, traditionally we see the mycoplasmas and the Mannheim hemolyticas when the animals get sick in the feedlot. And this was the first time we saw this bacteria genus present in these animals. So again, not only do we see a difference in animals across time points between sick and control animals, but in an early outbreak prior to weaning, we also see differences in those animals that get sick versus those that do not get sick. So I will just end with that. And of course, I want to thank all the people involved with this project. There's a number of scientists out at the center, including Larry and myself, and our virologist, Aspen Workman, technicians. Also, a number of summer students have worked on this project throughout the years, doing a great deal of work. And with that, Larry will come back up, and we can answer any questions you might have.